This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Welcome to Houston Sports Talk with your host, Robert Land.
Thanks for checking into the best Houston sports podcast, now part of the Believe Network. And hey, you might not recognize the face that you're seeing on the screen, but you'll know the voice of my guest in this one. Joining me is David DeLotti, a Houston sports radio fixture for 3.5 decades. You heard him on 610, 790, 740. 97.5. Am I missing a station or two, David?
I think you got them all.
Man, you've got some fascinating stories from your time in radio, but I'm not even sure when you started and how you got into the business. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, I started actually when I was about between 18 and 19. I knew a disc jockey at Kick Radio back in the 80s. And I had mentioned to him that, you know, I had a real interest in sports. I was a big sports fan. And he said, well, obviously I work at a radio station and we have a sports director there. Maybe you want to give him a call and see if he can intern or do something. Well, that guy was Barry Warner, and I called him and he invited me up there. He told me, I mean, I can't pay you, but you can hang out, you know, we'll get you press pass. You can learn the business, et cetera. And that was the early 80s again. And so I did, I accepted that I wouldn't be getting paid for a while. I was only again between 18 and 19. So I wasn't able to ask for much with no experience. So I accepted that. And after about a year to a year and 3 months of doing that, working for free, basically, they put me on the payroll. That was like 81, 82, somewhere in there. And from there, you know, the job grew and I became a full-fledged reporter. At the time, Kick Radio was a country station, but had a full news staff and full sports department, which tells you how much radio's changed in those years. But I ended up working there for about 10 years as a reporter. At one point, I became sports director. Barry moved on. Mark Berman took his place. Mark moved on to television. And so I was next in line. I was sports director for a couple of years. And then Kick decided they were no longer going to do sports coverage and very limited news coverage. So I became unemployed. Long story short, I ended up at 740 KTRH. That was in 1992. Russ Small was the sports director then. He hired me. I worked with Russ and Charlie Palillo and Rich Lord all the way to 99. And then I moved to 610 because Dickie Rosenfeld called me. He was the general manager at 610 at the time. They were looking for a sports reporter. Around 99 or 2000, I accepted a job at 610, which was the first sports station in Houston. Worked there to about 2004, and then 790 was created. At the time, Clear Channel was creating their own sports station in town to compete with 610, so 790 came on the air, and Charlie Palillo and I were the first two hires they made at 790. And actually, I was the first voice on 790 as a sports person because I did a sports update as the first element of the new format. And I worked there till 2009, got laid off there and ended up at 97.5, which was the ESPN affiliate, worked there 4 or 5 years. They didn't have any more room for me because the role of the sports reporter in radio was just had gone away. So I decided that was enough for me anyway. 35 or so years, I'd had enough. I wasn't really that anxious to get back into radio. So I became self-employed and still self-employed today.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that later on, but how did Astros legend Rusty Staub finance 1 year of college for you? I'm going to take you back to the start.
Actually, it was one semester. Like I said, Barry Warner hired me at Kick Radio in the early 80s. Barry and Rusty were good friends. Rusty still lived in Houston during the offseason, even though he played for the Mets at the time. Barry and Rusty were friends, and Rusty told Barry, hey, it was during the summer, during the season, I need my car up here. It was an SUV. I need my car in New York. Do you know anybody that's willing to drive a car up to New York for me? And I'll pay him. And I think I was 20, 21 years old. I don't remember the time. And so Barry came to me and said, hey, you want to make some extra money this summer? Drive Rusty's car up to New York and he'll pay you X amount of dollars plus expenses. And so I called Rusty and we made the deal. He told me where to go pick up the car in Houston. Took me 3 days to drive from Houston to New York. And man, was that culture shock, because I had grown up in Houston. And then I drove right into Manhattan. And that was a sight that was a sight, because I just wasn't used to that crowd and that pack and the, I'll call it friendliness of the New York people. Anyway, I'll never forget his address was 73rd and 3rd. That's the restaurant that Rusty owned in New York City, in Manhattan. He told me to drive it up to the restaurant, 73rd and 3rd, and he would meet me there. Believe it or not, I managed to drive through Manhattan and deliver that car to 73rd and 3rd without even as much as a fender bender, which is saying something, because I really didn't know how to drive in that New York traffic. But there I was. I pulled up, and there was Rusty in the restaurant, and he told me that he'd leave a press pass for me at the game that night, that the Mets were at home that night. I would talk to him, come see him in the locker room after the game. And sure enough, I did. I took the subway to Shea Stadium. That was another experience. Managed to get myself into Shea Stadium. I don't even remember how I did it, because I knew nothing about the subway system. I knew nothing about New York City. I mean, I was really a fish out of water. Anyway, got to the stadium, watched the game. Afterwards, went down to the clubhouse. I was already a reporter at the time, but Rusty introduced me to a couple of guys he was hanging out with. Keith Hernandez was one, Bob Baylor, and Ed Lynch. And those four, I think all four of those guys decided they were going to go eat after the game. Invited me along. And you want to take a guess where we ended up eating? It was at Rusty's restaurant. You know, for a kid that's, 20, 21 years old, that was a heck of an experience. But, and this is honest to God's truth, I needed the money to pay for the next semester of college. So he gave me, it didn't pay for the whole semester, but it paid for a good chunk of it. So that's how I paid for one semester of college, is taking Rusty's SUV up to New York for him.
You were a pinch hitter for the ultimate pinch hitter.
That's right.
Rusty style. Yeah. You've got so many stories from your career that sound like that never happened today. And I'll take you back to one of them, because in 1985, the Astros, they narrowed down their managerial candidates at that time to Hal Lanier, who of course led the incredible 86 team to the NLCS, and Jim Leland, who ended up with one championship, three Manager of the Year awards, and a plaque in Cooperstown. And David, you were right in the middle of that.
Yeah, that was very interesting. The Astros had fired Bob Lillis, I believe was the manager that they had fired. And so they were looking for a manager, and they wanted a young upcoming guy that hadn't managed before. It came down to two finalists for the job: Jim Leland of the Pirates, a coach for the Pirates, Hal Lanier, a coach for the Cardinals at the time. He worked for Whitey Herzog. As a reporter, it was my job to try to find these two guys, get in touch with them, get interviews with them, stay on top of the story, basically. So, you know, I stayed in touch with Lanier, but being in touch with Jim Leland was really interesting. He was a big hunter at the time. It was the off season and it was hunting season wherever he was. I don't recall how I got his number, how I initially contacted him, but I did. Told him I was a reporter in Houston. I know you're a candidate for the Astros managerial job. He was, believe it or not, happy to hear from me, because that meant that, you know, he was a real strong candidate to get the job. And so I asked him if I could stay in touch with him throughout this process. And I always did that with guys that I knew I was going to have to call multiple times in a few week period. He said it was fine. As a matter of fact, he said, I'm going to be hunting. Here's the phone number where you can reach me while I'm hunting. We didn't have cell phones back then, obviously. So obviously it was a landline. And sure enough, I called him, you know, 2-3 days later, I called him on that landline. We chatted some more about, you know, his chances. And he, and a lot of guys do this if they're not familiar with the market. He was asking me some questions because he figures reporters know what's going on. He wanted to know things like, okay, when do you think they'll make a decision? Are they talking about me as a real strong candidate, et cetera? But anyway, I got to know him really well because he did that more than once, go on these hunting trips and then give me his phone number, where to reach him. It was pretty interesting stuff, because I was talking to him, I guess, out in the woods somewhere in Ohio or wherever he went hunting. And at one point I found, at the time I worked for Kick Radio in the 80s. And for those who don't know, that was a country station. He said, I love country music. I especially like Ronnie Milsap. And you think you could send me a Ronnie Milsap? Back then they were albums. Ronnie Milsap album or two? Of course, I'm trying to please this guy that I'm trying to interview, and I may have to have a relationship with him going forward if he gets the job. So I said, sure. And sure enough, I went to the station a day or two later. He gave me his home address. I found a couple of Ronnie Milsap albums and put them in the mail to him. And I really didn't hear from him for a while. And next thing you know, Hal Lanier was named the manager. So Leland didn't get the Astros job, but that same offseason, he got the Pittsburgh Pirates managerial job. Lanier to the Astros, Leland to the Pirates. The Pirates visited the Astros the next season, of course, at the Astrodome back then. And here comes Jim Leland walking out of the dugout. He didn't recognize me because all of our conversations were on the phone, so he didn't know what I looked like. But what I went up to him, shook his hand, introduced myself. I said, hey, I'm David Dilotti. I'm the guy that hounded you during the offseason. And a big smile came across his face. And all he said was, I really enjoyed those Ronnie Mills albums. And so that was my story on Leland. It was pretty interesting following that managerial search and really interesting getting to know him. And of course, he went on to become one of the great, great managers in baseball. Lanier lasted 3 years. And never got another look, by the way, as a manager in the major leagues.
Yeah, you've painted quite the picture for me because I'm seeing Jim Leland in his hunting lodge, smoking a few Marlboros and listening to Smoky Mountain Rain with Millsap.
Yeah, so. Yeah, exactly. He did like to light them up, didn't he? He did it in the dugout too.
And I'm a fan of Millsap, so that's good stuff. And you had to do this on a number of managerial searches. Bobby Valentine, I remember you telling me he was not enthused to speak with you when he tried to reach you.
No, and Davey Lopes either. What happened on Bobby Valentine was I had no home number for him, obviously. And again, at the time, we didn't have cell phones. But I knew he had a restaurant in Dallas, in the Dallas area. I randomly called the restaurant one night, called it at night because I figured if he was going to be there, it's probably going to be when it's nighttime. I asked for Bobby Valentine. I tell him I'm a reporter from Houston. And this was when Valentine was Valentine was a candidate for the Astros job when Drake McClain bought the team. He fired Art Howe, the job that Terry Collins eventually got in 92. Anyway, I called Bobby Valentine because Valentine was a candidate and he was going to interview with the Astros. He did come to the phone and he wasn't really ugly on the phone, but he made it very clear that he didn't really appreciate me calling him. He said, you know, during the middle of our conversation, I'm trying to talk to him about the managerial search. He said, you know what you should be doing right now? I said, what? Watching the World Series game instead of interviewing me. That's what you should be doing. I said, okay, thanks, Bobby, but I still need to interview you because I'm doing interviews with the managerial candidates. And I think he gave me a couple of sound bites or something. I don't recall. But he made it clear he really didn't want to be called again. I did the same thing, the same managerial search with Davey Lopes. He was short and to the point that he did not want to be bothered. Lopes was also a candidate for the job Terry Collins eventually got. I found Lopes. That's the thing, at least back then, because there was no internet. You had to take educated guesses as to where these people might be. Well, Lopes was managing in the winter league somewhere, managing somewhere during the offseason. Called a hotel there in that small town, asked for Davey Lopes, and they ring his room. I was completely lucky. I had no idea that this was the hotel he was actually staying at. And he came to the phone, and I told him who I was, and there was dead silence for a minute there. And I knew that's never a good sign, as opposed to, hello, how can I help you, or anything like that. It was just dead silence. I said, look, Davey, I need to interview you, because I know you're a candidate for the Astros job. He said, I'm going to do this once and only once for you, and don't call me again. I said, okay. So I interviewed him, and I wanted to make sure, because he was cranky, I wanted to make sure it was okay that this was going to be aired. This was not off the record. He said, I don't care if it's off the record, on the record, print it, air it, do whatever you want to do with it, but don't call me again. I said, okay. And those are pretty much the words he used. Fortunately, I think he didn't get the job because I don't think he'd have been a friendly guy to have to deal with on a daily basis. Terry Collins got that job. He was a very friendly guy. I got along with Terry Collins extremely well. Rubbed some guys in the clubhouse the wrong way a little bit because he was so intense all the time. It was more like, in the dugout, he was more like a football coach than a baseball coach because you got to play 162 of them. You know, Robert, you can't have extreme ups and extreme downs every night. And I know on more than one occasion, players have to remind him of that. But I like Terry a lot. I thought he was an excellent game manager. I had a good relationship with him. I actually went out to eat with him a couple of times during the offseason after his first year. And Drayton ended up firing him 3 years into his tenure and then hired Larry Durker.
We're going to get to some of the other sports because you've got stuff on everything, but I'm going to stick with baseball for just a little bit longer because you really enjoyed covering so many of the Astros players over the years. And I want to ask you about a couple of guys and start with a legend, Nolan Ryan, 1985. He's named to the All-Star team, and I'll let you pick up the story.
Yeah, that was Mark Berman's a real good friend of mine. He and Barry Warner taught me the business, and I worked with Mark at Kick Radio before he went onto television. Mark and I talk about this, you know, once in a while, how lucky I got with the Nolan interview. Nolan was the Astros representative in 1985, and the game was in Minneapolis at the Metrodome. And Sandy Koufax was an honorary captain at that All-Star game. And anybody that knows Nolan knows that Sandy Koufax was his idol. That's who Nolan wanted to be like. He really idolized Sandy Koufax. So I thought it was going to be really cool for Nolan to be there and to meet Sandy Koufax and chat, whatever. I thought it would be really cool to get an interview with Nolan about that. But of course, the game's in Minneapolis. I'm in Houston. We did not travel to All-Star games. So I just took a shot at it, took a shot in the dark. It's the only thing I knew, you know, that may work. I didn't know. Again, there was no cell phones at the time. And so I said, I'll try this. We'll see what happens. I called the Metrodome, the basic operator for the whole stadium. I told her I was a reporter in Houston and that I needed to be passed through to the National League clubhouse. And this was, by the way, after Nolan has pitched his one or two innings, whatever he ended up pitching in that game. During the All-Star game, after your appearance, you go back in the clubhouse and start showering and changing, get ready to get out of there. So he wasn't in the dugout. I asked the receptionist to ring me through to the National League clubhouse because I needed to interview Nolan Ryan. I thought the next sound out here would be a dial tone. I never in my wildest dreams imagined she would patch me through. She said, okay, hold on. Sure enough, somebody answered the National League clubhouse. I'm sure it was whoever the clubhouse guy, equipment manager, whatever at the time. And I repeated my story. Hey, I'm David Delotti, Kick Radio in Houston. I'm a reporter here. I really need to speak to Nolan Ryan. And the guy that answered the phone said, well, hang on. And he comes back and he says, hang on, Nolan's changing. He says he'll be right with you. I was shocked. I was stunned.
This is unbelievable.
Next thing you know, the Texas drawl is on the other end of the phone. Yeah, how may I help you? And I said, Nolan, this is – he knew me a little bit at the time because I had been around the Astros a lot. So he knew he wasn't talking to a complete stranger. And I interviewed him. He did the interview on the phone. We aired it the next day on Kick. It was a heck of an experience, really. And I learned to do that, to adjust and whatever as a reporter over the years to get the stories or interviews you need to get. There's more than one way to do it. So you have to sort of adapt to the situation. And that's an example of it.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Now's the time to save 30% on wedding jewelry. Only on BlueNile.com. Make sure your wedding ring is the one with your pick of diamond and lab-grown diamond bands. All hand-finished and graded for excellence. Or surprise her with something blue she'll love for life, like a stunning pair of sapphire earrings. Blue Nile's jewelry experts are available 24/7 to help, from fit questions to style advice. Right now, get up to 30% off at BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Just two more Astros players, and just give me something real quick on what it was like covering Brad Lidge and the unforgettable Jose Lima.
Let me say this first. The Astros that I covered in the 35 years that I covered them, especially the 80s group, that was a phenomenally professional, friendly, accommodating group of guys to be around on a daily basis, which I was because I covered every game. That was a really good, great group of guys. Guys like Nolan, Craig Reynolds, Bill Doran, that whole group. Really, really good people. But to answer your question about Brad Lidge, for that time, for that period, he was probably the most accountable guy in that clubhouse. So what do I mean by accountable? Or people may not know what that means. That means if the loss is on him, or if he played in a big part of the loss, or he screwed up or whatever, he was always at his locker prepared to do interviews. He didn't duck. He didn't go hide in the training room. He didn't go hide in the eating area for the players where media is not allowed. He didn't go into any of the areas where media is allowed. He was at his locker ready to answer questions. And the most shining example of that is when he gave up the 2005 playoff home run to Albert Pujols. That just was crushing to Houston fans. They ended up winning the series, but that was, you know, a crushing blow in that playoff series. He stood at his locker. It must have been 20 minutes answering because there's waves. This is a NLCS. So there was reporters from all over the country, and there was wave after wave after wave of reporters around him. He answered every single question courteously, never sounded like he was bothered by it, never sounded like he was uptight about being asked the same thing over and over. He was there until every reporter got his question answered. That's the most shining example, but he was always, always very accommodating. Billy Wagner was the same way, honestly. And it's really tough on closers if the loss is specifically on you. You know, it's one thing if it's a team loss, but if you specifically and actually gave up a lead and lost the game as a closer, that is a tough one to swallow, you know, and it's tough to go ask that guy for an interview afterwards. Billy Wagner was the same way. Dave Smith back in the 80s, same way. Very stood by his locker, like Lidge, waited till all the interviews were done, then got dressed and whatever. But Lidge was really a good guy, very accountable. And again, the most important thing is his tone with reporters was not surly. Sometimes they'll say, I didn't like this. Sometimes they would say yes to the interview, but then they'd be surly or give you one-word answers, or they'd actually just shake their head yes or no when it's a radio interview. At that point, I'm saying, why'd you agree to do this? You could have just as easily said, no, I don't want to talk tonight, you know. But to sit here and go through all these ridiculous gyrations because you're ticked off, you know, what's the point in that? That wasn't Lidge, and it wasn't Dave Smith, it wasn't Billy Wagner. It wasn't most Houston Astros guys through the years.
Yeah, you said earlier you called Nolan Ryan. It was a miracle that Nolan took your phone call with Jose Lima. You might have gotten a call from Jose Lima. What? Hey, David, did you see what I do? Did you see what I do there?
Jose Lima never saw a microphone or a television camera he didn't like. The story I told on Facebook is one night I lost track of things. I should have known better than this. I was a veteran reporter at the time. I walked to him in the clubhouse and asked for an interview. And then it struck me, oh, heck, he's pitching tonight. It's a big no-no to ask the guy pitching that night for an interview. You just don't do that. Guys don't do interviews the day before they pitch. The days that they pitch. The day before you can, but the day they pitch, you can't ask for an interview. But it was in the afternoon, I don't know, 4:30, 5 o'clock, and I went up to ask him for an interview. And then I thought, oh, man, he's pitching tonight. I can't be doing that. So I said, sorry, Jose, I forgot you're pitching tonight. Just don't worry about it. He said, no, I don't care. Who cares about this? I don't care. Come on, what do you need to know? And that really typical of Jose Lima. He was never going to turn down an interview. Just a real fun guy to be around. And the other thing about Lima and the late Ken Caminiti, Dave Smith was this way, is when they talk to you as just another guy and not with a sense of superiority because I'm a big leaguer, you're a reporter. I never saw that with Lima, never saw that with Ken Caminiti, never saw that with a bunch of Astros. Dave Smith is another one, Billy Wagner. Because you know, Robert, some guys have that superiority complex as in you're lucky I'm even giving you the time of day. Those guys were not like that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the Astros have been a very unusual situation, very fun team to cover over the years. And then in the mid-90s, speaking of fun teams, you were covering the Akeem, Clyde, and Barkley Rockets. And there was a game that comes down to the final play. The Rockets lose the game on a missed shot. And David, it led to a little locker room soap opera drama.
Yeah, there. It did. That was one of the oddest post-game locker rooms I've ever seen. As you said, the game came down to the final shot. Rockets didn't make the shot. I think it was Clyde that took it. They lose the game. Afterwards, I mean, losing locker rooms are always pretty somber and low-key. And this was more of the same. And we interviewed Hakeem. But Hakeem started off right away. I don't recall his exact words. But he wanted it known. He was not happy with the call on the last play, the play that was run. And he said things like, this coach needs to understand that when you have a big man, you go to him on the final play. I'm a big man. You have to go to the big man. That's fundamental. Hakeem used to love to say that's fundamental to basketball. That's fundamental to basketball. And you know, when a superstar like that is taking a shot at his coach, that's news. That's big news. Especially guys with the stature of Hakeem and Rudy T, who was the coach at the time. You know, we were all sort of taken aback by, holy cow. You know, he's ticked off at Rudy because he didn't get the last shot and the Rockets lost. Barkley's locker was about two, maybe three seats over. So we, of course, have to get reaction from teammates. What do you all think of this? And so we all walk over to Charles Barkley's locker. And by the way, no matter how much he says it, Barkley loved media. But that's another story. We interview Charles Barkley and tell him Hakeem Olajuwon wasn't happy. He said that the last play should have gone to him, that Rudy needs to understand when you have a big man, that's who you go to on the last play for a bucket. Well, Charles didn't agree with Hakeem. And you know, Charles, he wasn't going to mince his words. First words out of his mouth were, well, that's because Hakeem is selfish. It's all about Hakeem or something to that effect. So he sided with Rudy. And now you really got a controversy in the locker room. I mean, can you imagine two big stars like this? One is mad at the coach. Another one is mad at the guy for being mad at the coach. So we said, holy cow, the story's getting bigger and bigger in this locker room. Clyde was another few seats over in the locker room. So we all go over to Clyde, ask Clyde about Hakeem's comments. Clyde agreed with Hakeem. It should have, even though Clyde took the last shot, I believe, it should have gone to Hakeem. He's our big guy. That's who should have taken the shot. Barkley, upon hearing that, had some few choice words for Clyde. Clyde had a few choice words across the locker room at him, and they weren't kidding around. This was, you can tell when players are just kidding around and when they're serious. This was a serious confrontation. They were getting more heated at each other. Of course, they didn't get along anyway to begin with, but this didn't help. So I was done with the interviews. I went outside the locker room into the hallway, and BJ, who was a Rock, the late BJ, Brent Johnson, was a Rocket scout at the time. I knew BJ pretty well. And I run into BJ, and part of BJ's role is to sort of be a conduit between the players and the head coach. You know, teams have a middleman between the players and the manager or the coach a lot of times. So I told BJ, you're two of your big stars in there squaring off. I would get in there if I were you. And BJ, I mean, he sprinted toward that locker room, flew the door open. I wasn't there to see what happened next, but I'm presuming he separated them, calmed them down, whatever he did. The next day, at shoot around or practice, whatever, I guess it was practice, Hakeem or Charles walks out to meet the media with Hakeem under his arm on this side, Clyde under his arm on this side, walk up to the media and tells him, you guys are destroying our team. We're getting along just fine. So obviously they had to make it look like everything was good after the, you know, the drama of the previous evening.
Yeah, I blame it all on the fact that Ernie Johnson wasn't there to calm things down a little bit for Charles. But and speaking of Hakeem, you're the only person I know, David, who bought recording equipment for Hakeem. I mean, really?
Yeah, I did. When you're hanging around players, whether it's practice, after games, whatever, you form a relationship with them, okay? Or you should, if you're a reporter, you should. I mean, I always tell young guys, or I told young guys, you got to create relationships. My big thing is when you walk into the local locker room, Astros, Rockets, Texans, going back to the Oilers, whatever, most of those faces should recognize you. Maybe they don't know your full name. Maybe they don't know a lot of, but they should recognize you that you're a guy that covers the team on a regular basis. It gives you credibility with them. And it also, when the, you know what, hits the fan and you need an interview from them, you know, if you haven't been around and yet you haven't created some kind of relationship, good luck. But anyway, to get to your Hakeem story, I knew Hakeem. Hakeem knew me. It's not like we were personal friends. It was a professional relationship. I covered the practices. I covered the games. So I had done my interviews after this one particular game. Hakeem taps me on the shoulder and says, I need to talk to you. When a player tells you that after a game and you're a reporter, 99% of the time, that's not good news. They're probably mad at a question you asked or a line of questioning or something has ticked them off. I had that confrontation with Vernon Maxwell. But anyway, Hakeem said, I need to talk. Okay, sure, Dream. So we go in this. He said, I need to buy a tape recorder and a microphone. And he pointed to my equipment, just like the ones you have. Okay. I didn't ask him what for. I said, okay, I can help you with that. He said, okay, I'll call you in a few days. Let me know how much those things cost. This was 95, 96, somewhere in there. Sure enough, I went, you know, looked up the supplier, called up the supplier, asked for the price of the tape recorder and microphone that Hakeem wanted. And I'll never forget the prices. Recorder was $300 back then in the 90s. That's pretty good money for a tape recorder. Microphone was $100. Okay. About a day or so later, I get a call from Hakeem's assistant. She said, Dream wants to talk to you. I need you to patch you through to Hakeem. I knew what it was about. And look, I love Dream to death. And I still see him around town once in a while. I run into him. Once in a long while, I run into him. And he's really a good guy. But he is not free with his money. He is tight with his money. So anyway, Hakeem comes on the line and says, hey, David, did you check out the prices for me? I said, I sure did. $300 for the recorder. What? $300 for a recorder? Yeah, Dream, $300 for the recorder and $100 for the mic. $100 for a microphone? So that, if you wanted the professional stuff, that's it. We're not talking Radio Shack here. This is you said you wanted the stuff I want to use, that I use. He said, okay, go ahead and order it and I'll pay you at next practice or whatever. We agreed to meet in the player's parking lot one day before practice to give him his equipment. It was $402. That was the cost for me. So I met him in the player's parking lot, and I brought the tape recorder and I brought the microphone. He had exactly four $100 bills. He says, I'll owe you $2. Like someone told me, I should have asked him to write a check for $2 and then frame the check. But anyway, he was very thankful, very appreciative, threw it in his car, went to practice. I never asked Hakeem why he wanted the recorder and the microphone. I later found out through somebody in the organization, I forget who, I don't know if it's another player, scout, somebody in the organization told me that's because on the road, Hakeem listens to sermons from Islam. That's how he occupies his time on the road, whether it's on the plane or in his hotel room. He wanted good quality equipment to listen to his religious sermons. And at that time, Hakim had really matured. He was really a very spiritual person. One of the elder statesmen of the NBA, and certainly an elder statesman in the Rockets locker room, I often saw him discuss life philosophies, not necessarily religion, but life philosophies with teammates. He always had Kevin Willis's ear. He was always talking to Willis about how to handle things, etc. He had become very devoted to his religion. In fact, there was a prayer room for Hakim at Toyota Center when they built Toyota Center. He was very devoted to the religion, and so that's what he wanted to do on the road, is listen to sermons.
Unbelievable. And just for anybody that's enjoying this conversation, by the way, look on our YouTube Houston History and Memories playlist for our 200 interviews with H-Town legends and some of the favorite sports radio guys like John McClain and Jerry Trupiano, Lance Zierlein, Tom Franklin, Mark Vandermeer that we've had over the years. And David, you had an interesting relationship also with a couple of owners. And in one of those stories that, again, would never happen today, you're hosting the nightly show with Russ Small and got a crazy on-air call. I love this story.
Yeah. That was during the stadium carousel in Houston. If you recall, every team wanted its new stadium. It was the beginning of that era when everybody was wanted new stadiums, and what they were doing was threatening to leave town if they didn't get a new stadium. And Bud Adams was the first. He was the first guy to ask for a new stadium, or else he'd be moving to Tennessee. There was a lot of people critical of him, you know, fans as well as media, because at the time we didn't know that this was just the tip of the iceberg in terms of stadium maneuvers and people, you know, teams demanding stadiums. And yet Russ Small and I were doing Sports Beat. That was the name of the talk show one night on 740. And it was during this whole Bud is demanding a new stadium. We were a little bit more critical about Bud demanding a stadium or else he would move to Tennessee. But we were also the Oilers flagship station, so we were not overly critical. Russ was actually their play-by-play guy at the time. But you've got to have some objectivity when you discuss these things. You can't just be on the air being the mouthpiece for the organization. Anyway, so we were a bit critical and a bit critical of Bud's history in the 70s. You know, some really poor decisions that he had made that made the Oilers in the early 70s, anyway, really a bad, bad team. And as we're talking, the producer says in our ear, hey, Bud Adams is on the line. He wants to get on the show. So Russ and I look at each other and say, okay, who's going to say no to the Oilers owner, especially at a time like this when he's, you know, the big topic in town? Because he wants a new stadium or he's moving. Well, we let Bud on the air and he proceeded to tell us, you know, how wrong we were. And then it became personal. I tried to interject something. He said, you wouldn't even know you weren't born yet. Then he started calling Russ Rush. And Russ and I looked at each other. Why is he calling? He's got to know you. You're his play-by-play guy. They called him Rush throughout the whole interview. Lambasted us as much, you know. It was not a good day, a good night for Bud, for me, for our station, for Russ. Because the conversation turned really ugly. It was not a very professional conversation. There wasn't really as much a discussion as it was him just wanting to tongue lash us.
I assume people, they picked this up though, this other place. So it was good for the show because you probably got a lot of publicity.
Yeah, we did. We got the following day. First of all, it was in the newspaper the following day. And then we got requests from other media outlets to run it. And 2 minutes after we got off the air, I get a call from Dave Pearson. He was at the Oilers media relations guy at the time. Again, you'd have thought he lost a friend because in a very solemn voice, I mean, I picked up the phone. He called me. He didn't even say, hey, this is Dave, whatever. He said, all the words I heard was, what happened? I told him what happened. Bud wanted to be on the air, so we let him on the air. And frankly, it didn't go very well. It didn't go very well at all. It was a bad look for Bud, bad look for us, bad look for everybody involved. And the next day, you're right, other media outlets, it was in the newspaper, the incident, other media outlets asked for the tape so that they could air it. Our general manager at the time was Laura Morris, and I don't know what kind of headache it caused her, but when I posted this story on Facebook, she replied, oh, yes, I recall well. It made for a long day the next day. So I don't know if she got a call from the Oilers or what happened. But, yeah, it was a pretty, pretty memorable evening. But on Bud, two things that were against him when he asked for his stadium and ultimately why he didn't get the stadium. Number one, he was the first to ask. He was the first to demand a new stadium. Whoever the first was going to be was going to get most of the bashing from media and fans because, again, in Houston, we just weren't used to that. The second mistake was, and I don't know, the first one wasn't a mistake, but, you know, he happened to be the first. The second issue with Bud really never knew the value of good PR. And by that, public relations and how important that is, especially for a professional franchise. By that, I mean the presentation of how he wanted a stadium. Mike McClure was the point man on that. And they just came off as making demands. okay? Sending letters to the city, sending letters here, sending letters there. They just didn't know how to massage it to where it would be so that fans, media, whoever could swallow it. It was you know, and this is a stretch of the word, but it was almost an extortion, you know?
Yeah, it didn't help that he had told the fans, hey, I'm okay if you rip out the Astrodome scoreboard and put in more seats, and then 2 seconds later go, oh, that's still true. Not enough.
Yeah, that's true. He did that in the late 80s. He did that in the late 80s.
And he still was nice enough to offer you a seat on his plane at one point, right?
Yeah, on his private plane. Yeah, that's another butt story. We were the Oilers flagship station. It was the year Steve McNair was drafted. The day after the draft, as is customary, I guess it's still customary, the owner sends his private jet to wherever the drafted player is, usually New York now, to pick him up and bring him back to Houston for a press conference, et cetera. Well, the morning after the draft, I got a call from Russ Small, our sports director, and said, hey, hope you're not busy today, or maybe it was the following day, tomorrow, whenever it was, because I need you to fly up to New York and fly back with Steve McNair. I said, what? At that point, I said, okay, I guess he wants me to interview him and get on a commercial flight and fly back. That's the impression that I had. He said, and by the way, you're going to be doing it on Bud Adams' plane. The Oilers had called our station, since we were the flagship, and asked if we wanted to send a reporter on the plane. Bud wasn't flying. The plane was just the pilot and the co-pilot. But they were going to send the plane to New York to pick up Steve McNair and bring him back. And would KTRH like to send a reporter along for that? Pretty cool experience, et cetera. And of course, our station said, of course. So the next morning, we flew out of Sugar Land Airport. I jumped on a plane with Bud's co-pilot on his private jet, flew across the country, north up to New York. And here I was sitting in a private jet alone, flying across the country. Landed in New York, don't know what small airport. Steve McNair, his agent, I believe his mom, I don't quite recall. Certainly Steve McNair and his agent. Get on the plane. John Lopez who from radio and previously the Chronicle, was actually in New York at the time. He reminds me that he caught the flight back with us. He caught a ride back home with us. We fly back. I interview McNair live off the airplane phone, however that worked. You know, it was a Saturday, I remember, because Rich and Charlie were still doing Sports Speed on Saturdays. It was called Sports Speed Saturday. And it was during that segment that we were flying back, put him on the air. It was quite the unique experience. It really was.
That's unreal. And you know, you knew a couple of owners. You had a relationship with Bud that was, you know, a typical Bud relationship, but a real different one with Drayton McLean. Tell me about
Drayton that. Drayton McLean is probably the most unique figure that I've covered on an everyday basis. I know there's other unique figures in sports. I'm talking about just me covering in Houston on a unique basis. He was the ultimate salesman. He was always selling 24/7. You could call him at 9 o'clock at night at home. And if he recognized you as a reporter or something like that, the sales pitch would begin. In this case, selling the Astros and how wonderful everything's going to be. Drayton really was an interesting, interesting guy. But I don't want to paint him as, you know, he wasn't a complete innocent. He was also a sharp businessman that had to make some really tough decisions that not a whole lot of people within the organization agreed with. But as far as my relationship, the first time I met Drayton was at a spring training game the same spring or immediately following the fall when he bought the Astros. I was standing in line to buy a hot dog at a spring training game. I was covering spring training in Florida. And the guy behind me was Drayton McLean in line. He reached out his hand, and I guess he recognized me as being a reporter that had been covered him, reached out his hand, introduced himself as if I didn't know, and asked me, can I buy you a hot dog? I mean, that was Drayton. I said, no, Drayton, I think I'll get my own hot dogs. And I asked for the one thing you do as a reporter, every chance you get, high profile figures, ask for a phone number so you can reach them. So sure enough, I did. I asked for his phone number. It was listed in Temple, so he wasn't giving me any secrets. But he said, here's my number at the office. Here's my home number in Temple. And I'll never forget his words. If you ever have a question about the Houston Astros, you just call me. Well, I'm guessing more than once he regretted making that promise, because I certainly took him up on it over the years. When they made the Randy Johnson trade, I think that happened on a Friday night, and it happened at midnight. Jerry Hunsicker was able to pull that thing off right before the stroke of midnight, the trade deadline. So I called Drayton early the next morning. Drayton was always ready to go, and typically at his office, even on Saturdays by 7 or 7:30. But I called him at home, and his wife answered, Elizabeth, and she was a sweetheart lady too, by the way. She said, honey, he just went out to get the oil changed on his car, but he'll call you when he gets back, which, of course, I'm thinking a billionaire's, I guess, went to his mechanic, told him to put it up on the rack and change the oil. Anyway, yeah, a couple hours later, Drayton called back and did an interview. And Drayton's callbacks, at least for me, and I know he did this with other people. When I'd answer the phone, hello, his first words were always, this is your good friend, Drake McClain. It was always, this is your good friend, Drake McClain. Once in a while, this is your buddy, Drake McClain. How are you? Just fine, Drake. I've got to do an interview with you. All right, you go right ahead. You know, that was typically his approach. I've seen the other side of him a couple of times. He was he got mad at me, really mad at me one time. During an Astros game, I had found out through sources around baseball, the Astros were interested in David Wells, who at the time was pitching for the White Sox. So I went down to Drayton's seat, asked if he could walk out where they serve food and stuff so I could do a quick interview with him. And he said, sure. Again, Drayton always accommodating. And I asked him about David Wells. Well, he is not supposed to comment on a player that's under contract for another team. That's tampering. I asked him if there was interest in acquiring David Wells. He said, well, there's interest in acquiring David Wells. And he mentioned it by name, which is a huge no-no in MLB. Yeah, we'd be interested in David Wells, but we think the cost might be too high, blah, 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 blah. Okay, great. I had a little scoop there. I went back. I aired it later that day as well as the next morning. I was at Sports Radio 610 at the time. And next thing I know, the phone rings. My phone at 610 rings. And this time he was not my good friend, Drayton. He said, David, this is Drayton. I thought we were good friends. That's how he phrased it that time. I said, uh-oh. I really didn't know what it was about. I really didn't. Until he said, why did you say that I mentioned David Wells? I said, well, Drayton, because you did. No, I didn't mention David Wells. I said, I tape you did. No. So we went back and forth like that. What am I going to do? Argue with him for an hour? I said, okay, well, I didn't mean to upset you. And I certainly wasn't trying to cause you any problems with MLB. Okay, whatever. We hung up. I called one or two sources at the Astros at the time who later notified me that the White Sox had called Drayton and really reamed him out pretty good about mentioning one of his players publicly. And that's what Drayton was upset about.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
So Ken Caminiti, I want to ask you about him because he's going to the Astros Hall of Fame this summer. What do you think of when you hear Ken Caminiti's name?
One of the toughest players in baseball over a 20, 30-year period. He played with more pain and more injuries than people realize. The other things I think is that he was a heck of a player. Excellent defensive third baseman. Won an MVP in 94. But Cam, he needed to go to counseling at a point, you know, it's not for me to discuss the details of that. When he was at counseling, he was obviously absent from the media. Nobody knew what was going on, etc. I was trying to get a hold of him to find out what was going on with him after he got out of counseling. I guess I didn't have a cell number, home number, whatever. For some reason, I couldn't get a hold of him except through the Astros clubhouse. And Dennis Laborio was the Astros, the late Dennis Laborio, great guy, by the way, was the Astros clubhouse attendant at the time. I called Dennis Laborio one day. This was during the offseason, by the way, but I called Laborio one day in the clubhouse and I said, can I leave a message for Cammy? He said, sure. He took my number down, said, I'll pass it on to him if I see him. Okay, thanks. I thought either Dennis will forget about it or Cammy won't return the call or whatever, even though I know Cammy really well at that time. Next day, he called. I picked up the phone. You know that Caminiti was. Are you looking for me? Sounded like Rocky a lot. Sylvester Stallone and Rocky. I said, yeah, Cammy, I need to do an interview with you. He said, okay, meet me at my trainer's house tonight. He trained at night, like at 10 o'clock at night. Meet me at my trainer's house tonight in Sugar Land. I'm going to talk to you and Mark Berman, and that's all I'm doing. Okay, great. Sure enough, Went over there. He did an interview, discussed his issues. That interview got a lot of play the next day. That was one of my Cammy stories. Another one, it was spring training. And I was at KTRH at the time. And I asked Cammy if he could go on our show 6 or 7 in the evening for 20, 25 minutes, do an interview from spring training. He said yes. Next day, he found out there was a team function that night. He couldn't do it. It was a team function he couldn't get out of. And I don't know that he wanted to get out of it, but he just couldn't do it. So he apologized and said, and I said, all right, it's cool. We'll do it another time. He said, I'll make it up to you. What if I buy you dinner before spring training's over? I said, all right, don't worry about it. That's fine. A couple of days later, I was still at spring training. And I told him what hotel I was staying at. I'm just sitting in my hotel one afternoon. Phone rings. It's him again. Hey, it's Cammy. You want to go to Carrabba's? Wow. He's actually going to go through with this, buy you dinner. He was really serious about it. And so said, sure, I'll meet you there for dinner. Sure. So we met at Carrabba's. I walked up, and actually Craig Biggio and Casey Candel were also joined us for dinner. But I tell that story just because, again, he's one of those guys that never really talked with a superiority complex. I think he just saw me as another guy that he was supposed to do a favor for, forgot to do it, so now he's trying to make up for it. But that was Ken Caminiti. He's one of the most kind-hearted, really kind-hearted people that I covered in any sport. He really was. Loved his kids. He talked about his kids and his wife all the time. But unfortunately, you know, it didn't end well for Cammy. And it was a sad day for me when he passed, because I had developed this relationship with him. You know, I never really became friends with anybody I covered, because that's a dangerous, slippery slope. But I've gotten close enough to him, you know, you hear of a guy's death. That was not a fun day.
Last thing I want to ask you about, and I want to ask you this because it's the 30th anniversary this month of the Rockets' first championship. What do you remember about the night that they won, or, you know, something about covering that title run?
Yeah, the title run was really fun to cover because, again, that team had some really, as far as media goes, okay, I'm looking at it from a media perspective, had some good guys to cover, like Kenny Smith, Hakeem. Rudy was just a wonderful, wonderful guy, just one of the best. So I was happy for them, first of all, and happy really for Rudy. He had been in that Rockets organization since, what, 71, 72, however long it was. He was Mr. Rocket. And for him to take over the head coaching job, win a championship, for Dream to really cement himself as one of the all-time greats. And they had a lot of – I mean, Otis Thorpe was a very good player, but that team was really Hakeem and a bunch of really good role players. You know, Kenny Smith was a terrific shooter as a guard. But it's not like, you know, it's not like they you see today where you have three superstars on a team, because they didn't get Clyde until the following year. But the thing that I remember, I guess, when the confetti started coming down right after they had won the championship, I was in awe because it was the first time I had covered a city championship. And it was actually the first. Well, if you go back to the AFL Oilers, they won the AFL championship. But let's face it, it was the first big time championship for the city of Houston, unless I'm missing something. So those are two things that come to mind as, wow, I'm covering this first championship, and it's at home, and this place is going crazy. And I just remember the locker room. You could barely move in that locker room. There were so many people in there. I remember Rudy being – I was really happy for Rudy because he was always nice to me, really good guy, really being happy for all the guys on that team. Vernon could have his days. He didn't like media a lot, but other days he was very friendly, so you just never knew which Vernon you were going to get. But all in all, I don't have any specific story on that as to just – I was happy to be covering that and be part of that experience, because that's something, you know, I can tell my grandkids or whatever at some point.
Yeah, it was just an amazing moment just for the city. And like you said, it's the first major championship, and the whole city was ready to explode after so many disappointing losses over the years. I want you to just tell people a little bit about what you're up to these days, what you're doing, because, you know, we don't see you around as much anymore.
Yeah, I do. I'm completely self-employed. So my stress level is like at an all-time high at all times. Now, I'm in real estate. I'm an agent. I'm a realtor. And I really enjoy that. I'm also a business owner, Supercuts franchise. I had two locations. Unfortunately, COVID wiped one of our locations out, as it did with so many small businesses. That was a horrible time. But I have another location that's doing well. It's in the Woodlands. So I do that, and I help people buy and sell houses. Believe it or not, I don't watch – really, the only team I follow now is the Astros. I really – and I'll watch a Texans game on occasion, especially if they're going to be competitive like they were last year. But I really don't watch that much sports anymore. I just did it for 35 years, and I've seen enough sports. It's just – I'm not going to continue to, you know, be glued to the TV.
Mark Berman and you are not in the same boat. I get the feeling from Mark on social media. And Dave, I just want to thank you for not only the sensational stories, but for being such an incredible pro sports journalist. That's something that this business needs as much of as possible. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. The Houston sports media vets have always treated me with such kindness and generosity. You know, all the guys that have been around, that were around and have been around from the 70s and 80s and 90s. And just, I can't thank you enough, David, for doing this.
Oh, thank you for having me. Are you kidding? My pleasure.
You're listening to Houston Sports Talk.
Hey, don't forget to support us by subscribing and commenting on YouTube. You can always listen to us on Spotify, Apple, or your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends about us and share our show links on social media. Spread the word, everybody. Thanks for listening.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.